Let me add my welcome to Andrew. So I'm also Andrew, one of the pastors here. It's great to see some new faces. And welcome back to the Gospel of John. When we first began Grace Church Greenwich 2 years ago, our first sermon series was in John chapters 1 to 4. And then we took a pause and went all over the Bible. We've done 2 Corinthians and Jeremiah and Ecclesiastes just recently. And now we're back in John and picking up at chapter 5, which is where we got to. And we're going to be in John until Christmas. Chapters 5 and 6. So page 890 of the Gospel of John, 890. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem, by the sheep gate, a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has 5 roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who'd been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he'd already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water's stirred up. And while I'm going, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Get up, take your bed, and walk." And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Now, that day was the Sabbath. So the Jews, or the Jewish leaders, said to the man who'd been healed, "It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed." He answered them, "The man who healed me, that man said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk?'" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn as there was a crowd in the place. Afterwards, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." This is why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. We'll pause there and pick up the story next week. That's reason enough, isn't it, to come back to see what happens next. Well, you see on the inside of the service sheet, there is an outline which will help you and some questions to discuss over coffee if you'd like to at the end. But my opening question is this: do you believe that Jesus is the Son of God? And do you believe that he can bring life? And you might be thinking, well, obviously I do, because this is a church, and I jolly well expect everybody else to believe the same thing. Of course, that's what Christians are supposed to believe, isn't it? That Jesus is the Son of God. I was actually talking to a neighbor earlier this week and telling him about the church where I work. And I said, we've got people in every decade up to 92. Betty, nice to see you. Apart from their 70s, I think we've got a gap in their 70s. And my neighbor said, "Oh, maybe I should come." He said, 73. I said, "Oh, maybe you should." And then he caught himself and said, "Oh, but I don't know what kind of religious pre-commitments are required to come to your church." And I said, oh, no pre-commitments. There'll be people from all sorts of backgrounds with all sorts of beliefs. And I don't want to assume today that everybody believes that Jesus is the Son of God. It might be you're here just looking into Christian things, in which case you're very welcome. And that's just a reminder for the regulars, do bring people who are skeptical about these things to join us Sunday by Sunday. But it might be, I guess, for most of us here are Christians, and we'd say, yes, I do believe Jesus, the Son of God. But I want to slightly raise the stakes on that and say, how much do you believe it? How much would you stake on that belief? How sure are you that Jesus is the Son of God? And it might sound like it's just a historical question. Who was this man 2,000 years ago? So I've put the second part of the question there. Do you believe that he can bring life. At the end of John's Gospel, his account of Jesus, he explains why he's writing in John chapter 20 and verse 30. Let me read it to you. Right towards the end of the book, he says, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Now, it might be you're thinking, I already do believe that. And I want to say, how much do you believe that? How certain are you of that? For example, if you really believe that Jesus can bring life, eternal life, life from the grave, that's going to profoundly change your attitude to death. You won't be afraid to die if you know that Jesus can get you through death, if there is life in his name. If you believe that Jesus really can bring life, then you might sit looser to this life. Jesus will say in chapter 12 of John that whoever follows him, whoever serves him must follow him. Whoever hates his life in the world will keep it for eternal life. Now that's quite a tall ask, isn't it, for a disciple? Jesus says, give up your life here, hate your life here for the sake of the life that I can give you. And so following Jesus begins to look costlier and the stakes are higher. And we start to say, I want to be really sure about it. If you're asking that kind of commitment. If it's just a hobby for Sundays, I don't have to be that sure. But if you're asking me to start to base my decisions of all of my life on this, I want to really know that it's true. And that's why John's writing, so that we would know whether today you're a Christian or a non-Christian, so that we would be convinced that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing we may have life in his name. And in order to convince us, John has recorded as an eyewitness various extraordinary things that Jesus did. And we're going to focus on this one over the next 3 weeks. This is an event in Jerusalem about 2,000 years ago at a pool called Bethesda, where a man who had been an invalid for 38 years is healed. It's a miracle, and John hopes that the miracle will persuade you of the truth. Now, just before we go into it in detail, and we will do, I want to just take a step back and ask the question of, are miracles scientifically impossible? And are miracles historically shaky? And I want to just take a moment to address both those questions, and then we'll look at this particular miracle. So the first one, I haven't put a heading for this because I've only decided latterly, after I handed in the outline, decided to add this. But add yourself a little heading, are miracles scientifically impossible? And the argument goes like this. In a bygone age, people were naive about science. And they used to think that it rained because God had a big watering can in the sky. And so when it rained, they would give thanks to God. Thank you, Lord, for tipping up your watering can. And how naive they were, because of course now we understand about evaporation and condensation and the water cycle. And we've got a natural explanation for it. People used to believe that you got ill because of demons and evil spirits, and you got better because of miracles. But now we understand about T cells and antibodies and doctors and surgeons. And so now we don't need to say thank you to God. We say thank you to the NHS, and we've got a perfectly natural explanation. So, of course, these people back then, all that time ago, they were just naive about science. They got excited about things like this. But of course, we know that miracles are scientifically impossible, aren't they? Maybe you've heard that objection. And I've got a one-sentence reply, but it's quite a complicated sentence, so I'm going to say it and then explain it. Here's the reply. Don't confuse observed uniformity with divine necessity. Okay, there we are. Simple reply. Well, it's one sentence, not very simple. Don't confuse observed uniformity with divine necessity. Observed uniformity just means that the universe tends to behave in the same sort of way day by day by day. In fact, that's what makes science possible. Let's imagine you were interested in testing the theory of gravity, but instead of dropping an apple, as it's supposed that Isaac Newton did, let's say you drop bananas, and you drop a banana out of your upstairs window, and you time the time it takes to reach the ground. And you know the distance, and so you calculate the acceleration due to gravity, and you measure it to be about 9.8 meters per second. And then you go up the top of the gherkin in the city, and this time you can't drop the banana because the gherkin's curved. So you throw the banana, and you measure the acceleration, and it's 9.8 meters per second per second. Then you get on a plane to Italy on holiday, and you go up the Leaning Tower of Pisa, persuading them to let you pass, even though it's closed off for safety reasons. And you drop off a banana at 9.8 meters per second per second. It's the same for different bananas dropped from different places on the Earth. And so you formulate your scientific theory, your theory of gravity. Actually, Newton got there quite a long time before you. But anyway, you publish your theory of the acceleration of bananas at the Earth's surface, 9.8 meters per second per second. Now, that's science. Because we observe the same thing happening uniformly, the same way, day by day, we formulate a theory to describe it. We say, I've uncovered a principle of nature. Bananas always accelerate towards the ground at 9.8 meters per second. However, just because things usually work like that, don't assume that God has to do them like that. Don't confuse the uniformity that you observe with something that binds God, that's necessary for God to do. Don't confuse observed uniformity with divine necessity. There's nothing to stop God, if he wanted to, just changing the numbers. And he could do that every day, couldn't he? He could say, tomorrow, I'm a bit bored of 9.8 meters per second per second. I think I'll multiply it by 10. And so God changes the underlying gravitational constant, and it causes chaos in greengrocers' shops everywhere because all the bananas would crash through the shelves and suddenly become extremely heavy. You wouldn't be able to get out of bed because it would seem like somebody had turned up gravity. I know it sometimes does feel like that on a Monday morning. The point is that God doesn't usually do that because he likes order. So ordinarily, you can't walk on water at room temperature. You can in the Baltic Sea in the winter because it's frozen. But God has so arranged the laws of water displacement that isn't usually possible. If you die, you don't normally expect to see people again 3 days later and to greet them. And if you did, they would be very surprised, because God doesn't usually raise the dead on that sort of timescale. He will on the last day, but he doesn't normally do it here as we observe it. But just because it's unusual doesn't mean it's impossible. And actually, all the atheist scientists is doing is confusing what they usually observe with something that's possible but rare. First thing to say. So are miracles scientifically impossible? No. They're just scientifically unusual, very unusual. Secondly, though, are they historically shaky? Are they based on shaky evidence? And for this, I've got my acrostic to help me remember. Jesus signs are super. That isn't me just saying they're great. That's saying they're S-U-P-E-R. And when I first came up with this acrostic, I was trying to think for ages of a word that would contain all the points I wanted. And I came up with the word purse, P-U-R-S-E. And I thought, excellent, this summarizes everything about miracles. Unfortunately, purses don't have anything to do with miracles, unless you're talking about dodgy American evangelists who ask you to make a donation to their ministry. That's slightly unfortunate. But I thought, anyway, it's a good word, purse, P-U-R-S-E. And just before I gave the talk, the secretary at church said, purse, that's an anagram of super. So thanks very much to Mary. Here we are, super. Jesus' signs are, S, they are surprising. In other words, people in the first century react to them in exactly the same way as people in the 21st century would react. They are extremely surprised. They don't say, you're walking on water. Well, we don't know anything about the physics of water displacement, so that isn't particularly unusual. They don't say, you were dead 3 days ago, but here you're alive. Well, fair enough. I guess that's maybe the way biology works. No, they are very, very surprised. They're astonished. They say things like, we've never seen anything like this before. You don't have to know much about science to know that these things are extraordinary. People are surprised. Secondly, Jesus' signs are uncontested. U for uncontested. By which I mean that even Jesus' opponents concede that he does them. I remember being very persuaded by that when I was first looking into Christian things. It's not only the Christians who believe that the miracles happened. Did you notice that in the reading? The Jewish authorities are very angry with Jesus because he did these things on the Sabbath. But the whole basis for their case against him is that he did them. If Jesus hadn't done any healings on a Saturday, they'd have no reason to get annoyed. So they grant that the miracle happened. They're just annoyed that it happened on a day that they don't think Jesus ought to have done it. They are uncontested. And we'll see that as we go on again in John's Gospel. Thirdly, they are public. If I told you that 10 years ago, in the Forest of Dean, when I was on my own, I levitated a fox for 38 seconds, and therefore I'm pretty impressive and you should follow me. I wouldn't, Tom is giving that exact look, this is what we need for, as a look of wry unimpressedness. Yeah, exactly, that's how I expect you to look, like, really? Seriously, you expect me to believe that? Because there's no witnesses, you've just got to take my word for it. Similarly, in Islam, the claim is that Muhammad met an angel in a cave on his own with no other witnesses and received the dictation of the Quran. And no one can check that or verify that. But notice this miracle occurs in a named place. It's in Jerusalem, the capital city. It's in a place called Bethesda, near the Sheep Gate. We know exactly where it happened. It happens with named witnesses. John is there. Even some of the opponents of Jesus are there. It is public. Fourthly, Jesus' miracles, are explained. They're not just random things he does. They are signs with a purpose. There's a reason for them, and we'll look more of that in a moment. And finally, they are responsive. I was thinking the other day, how can we tell the difference between a real miracle and Jesus being just a clever magician like David Blaine? You know, he gets all the tricks set up. Or like Paul Daniels, depending on what generation you're from. How do we know it wasn't just Jesus setting up a magic trick? And the answer is, Jesus' miracles frequently come in response to a situation that he couldn't have set up. It's not like he says, hey, why don't you pretend to be a bit paralyzed by this pool, and then I'll come along, and then you can pretend to walk, and then, great, and I'll give you a fiver for doing it for me. Because this man has been here for 38 years, and Jesus comes along and then encounters him. I mean, it's a lot of forward planning, isn't it? Jesus going along at his birth, saying, excuse me, but for the next 38 years, please could you pretend to be paralyzed? And in chapter 9, we meet a man who's born blind. I mean, how do you even persuade a toddler to pretend to be blind? Because in about 30 years' time, I'm going to come and do a miracle. Now, Jesus is responding to situations that he didn't set up. Well, unless he's God, he sets them up. But as a man, he's not able to set them up. So, Jesus' signs are historically very credible. They're surprising. People react like skeptical people who don't expect this to happen would react. They're uncontested. His opponents agree that they happened. They're public, in named places, with named witnesses. They're explained. There's a point to them. They are responsive. Jesus' miracles really happened. And John records it because he wants us to believe that Jesus really is the Son of God and we can have life in his name. Now, this particular miracle, of course, the scholars have scoffed at, and this really amuses me because back in the 19th century, people were scoffing at this, particularly at the idea that there was a pool in called Bethesda with five covered colonnades, verse 2. And people said, like, how ridiculous, because pentagonal geometry would not have been known in the first century. This is clearly John sort of making it up. Maybe it's an allegory, like the five books of Moses, one colonnade. So as a sort of metaphor, maybe a metaphorical pool with metaphorical colonnades. And then there was an excavation, and they found a pool. Actually, they found two pools, Hezekiah's pool and then an extension. And the two pools were separated with one colonnade at the dam between the two, and then there were two along each edge. So the five colonnades weren't in a pentagon at all. They were in an H shape, but they were one, two, three, four, five. It's one of those excellent archaeological egg-on-the-face moments, as I call them, where the scholars realized that John really did know Jerusalem of the first century and records a real event. Well, let's look at the event itself. I've got four brief headings. Number one, the helplessness. At this pool, Verse 3, lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who'd been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew he'd been there a long time, he said, "Do you want to be healed?" I mean, I guess that's an obvious question, isn't it? Of course I do. But the sick man answered him, "Sir, I've no one to put me into the pool while the water is stirred, and while I'm going, another steps down before me." Now, if you look down at the bottom of your page, if you've got extremely good eyesight and you look at the tiny, tiny writing, you can see a little extra bit that some manuscripts add, verse 4. People lay there, quotes, waiting for the moving of the water, for an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred the water. Whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was healed of whatever disease he had. So the idea is that there's this pool that has magic properties, and every now and then there's a little whirlpool in it, and the first one in gets healed. Well, there's a whole crowd of people all the way around the outside, and it's quite a sad situation, isn't it? Because some of them are blind, so I guess they don't get to see when the pool is stirred, and others of them are lame, so they can see when it's stirred, but they can't get to the water. And one of my friends slightly unkindly said, "Do you think that the invalids, when they see it, they creep because they don't want the blind people to hear that they're going for the water and then diving in?" But it is a picture of helplessness. Now, these words probably aren't original to John. They're added later. And it's probably actually a local superstition. We know that just after Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans, there was a temple built on the same site to one of the Greek gods of healing, whose name I can't pronounce. It is Asclepius, the god Asclepius. And apparently the Hippocratic Oath originally was, "I swear by Apollo the physician and by Asclepius." Asclepius was a healing god, and probably the superstition had already begun by Jesus' time. This wasn't really somewhere that God was healing people. But if you're an invalid for 38 years, you're desperate, I guess, and you'll be gullible, and you'll go for anything that's going. And here's a rumor that people say, if you're the first one in, then you can be healed. And he stakes his whole hope on this. And yet he's never the first one in because he's paralyzed. He can't get to the water. It's sort of doubly sad, isn't it? I mean, it's a superstition with all his hopes in it. And yet even this, his hopes are dashed. I guess it's a bit like if you've ever been to one of those special pilgrimage sites like Lourdes. And people go there when they're sick. They got cancer. And the chemo didn't work. But maybe going to Lourdes will help. And it's a superstition. The Bible doesn't say God will heal people there. But all of your hopes are pinned on it. This man is desperate. The helplessness. And then the healing. And it's so brief, isn't it? It just takes a couple of sentences. A question. Do you want to be healed? I do. And then a word, get up, take your bed and walk. And at once the man was healed and he took up his bed and walked. That is an extraordinary thing. And a 38-year paralysis, I don't know the medicine. But even modern medicine couldn't do this, could it? I mean, you could have surgery on your limbs, maybe. But then there'd be weeks and weeks of physio. This man gets up, picks up his bed and walks down the road. He is instantly healed. Notice, though, only one of the men is healed. I think this is very significant because sometimes we look at Jesus' healings and we imagine they ought to be the normal expectation for Christians. Maybe Jesus wants to heal everyone who's in a wheelchair. Actually, I've got a very good Christian friend. He's a minister. He's been in a wheelchair all the time I've known him. And he still uses it. Why is that? Maybe Jesus wants to heal everyone who's blind. But we've got some people in our congregation who are really struggling with their eyesight. And they're still struggling. So why is that? Well, that's because Jesus didn't come into the world to heal all blindness or all paralysis. And of all of the people crowding these colonnades, only one of them gets healed. Because the point of it is to be a sign. And signs by nature are very, very unusual. These miracles, they're a departure from what is ordinarily expected by the laws of physics and biology to point to something about Jesus. And Jesus didn't come to heal everyone. He healed this man as a sign. But it causes a huge rumpus. And the reason is, verse 9, that day was a Sabbath. And the Jews held that on the Sabbath, you weren't supposed to do any work. They got that from the Ten Commandments. But they took that to the nth degree. So here's a man walking along with his bed. I mean, give the man a break. This is the first time he has walked anywhere for 38 years. And all they can do is mutter and go, he shouldn't be doing that on a Saturday. I mean, he's not exactly going out for work, is he, from doing a 9-to-5 shift. He's just walking home with the bed that he used to... That's work. And that taking it to the nth degree, it still does happen. So I remember visiting Israel, and there's particular places where the very, very orthodox, strict Jews live. And there are regulations like don't turn on a light switch on a Saturday because the light switch is high up the wall, and maybe that's work for your finger to turn on the light. And there was even a special urinal that was one that wouldn't flush on a Saturday. I'm not even joking. There was a special kosher urinal that wouldn't flush on a Saturday in case that was work. And they've got this sort of pernickety, taking it to the nth degree interpretation of the Sabbath. Actually, some of us on Wednesday learnt what the Sabbath is actually about in our first installment of our Bible overview. The Sabbath is meant to be a celebration of God's rest because of all the work of creation that he's finished and completed. And it's a sign of the perfect world that we're looking forward to when everything is well. But they didn't take it that way. They're very pernickety about it. Now, just consider, what answers could Jesus give to people complaining about him doing a healing on a Saturday? Imagine you were Jesus. What would you say to these Jewish leaders? And the answer, there's all kinds of answers he could give. So he could say, stop being so absolutely ridiculous and absurd about your interpretation of what counts as work. The bloke is just going for a walk for the first time in 38 years. Give him a break. He could say something like, you've misunderstood what the Sabbath command was about. It was supposed to be a blessing, not a straitjacket. And Jesus does say something like that in Mark's gospel. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Jesus, he could point out the hypocrisy of it. So he could say, for example, well, look, you guys, I bet you put a bowl of water out for your dog on a Saturday on a hot day. So you help your dog out, and I'm not allowed to help this guy? What kind of double standards is that? Elsewhere, Jesus gives that kind of answer. He says, look, if you've got an animal that falls into trouble on a Saturday, you help it. But you don't let me help a human being? That would be a pretty good answer. But instead here, Jesus gives about the most confrontational possible answer. And I think this is the equivalent of pouring petrol on a fire. Jesus says, verse 17, my Father's working, and so I'm working. I went to university in a place where there was an immaculate lawn that only the master of the college was allowed to walk on. And there were signs everywhere saying, keep off the grass. And I think, Ed, were you telling me the other day about the probably apocryphal story of some students who, for fun, one summer, I can't remember who it was, it might have been Ed, he mentioned it to me, for fun one summer, with all the tourists around, they decide to stage a sort of drama. And one of them walked on the grass, and the other one pulled out a gun and went bang and shot him. And obviously, you know, it's fake gun, except if it really happened. But it's a great apocryphal story because the university was very, very strict about not walking on the grass. Only the master was allowed to walk on the grass. Now imagine you were caught walking on the grass. And there's all sorts of defenses that you could try to give, I guess, before you were shot. But this answer would be to say, well, the master walks on the grass, and so I do. If it's good enough for him, it's good enough for me. See the implicit claim of authority in that? It's like if you were to break into Buckingham Palace. There you really would be shot, I think, for walking on the grass. Well, the Queen walks on the grass. The Queen uses this garden, so I do. Here it's even more extraordinary. Because Jesus is pointing to the truth that God works on Saturdays. It's just as well, isn't it? I mean, God does advocate a day of rest for Christians, and there's more to understand about that. But if God absolutely put up his feet once a week for 24 hours, we would be in trouble, wouldn't we? I mean, the law of gravity, suspended for 24 hours. And so on. You know, giving people every breath they have, we can do about 3 minutes without breath, can't you? But not 24 hours. So God is always working. So Jesus says, my Father's always working, and so am I. Extraordinary. We'll look at that more next week, except to say, notice that what Jesus does is a sign. It's a sign that he does on a Saturday the sorts of things that his Father does on a Saturday. What sort of things does the Father do? What sort of things does God do? God is the life giver. God is the one who sustains creation. And so Jesus says, that's what I'm doing. Did you see what I did at that man for 38 years crippled? I gave him life. That's the sort of thing that God would do on a Saturday. And so that's why I'm doing it. A pointer to the life giver. And then more subtly, when Jesus finds the man, he says to him, verse 14, see your well, sin no more, so that nothing worse may happen to you. So it's a pointer to judgment day, isn't it? Make sure that you take this opportunity and God's amazing mercy to you. Make sure you take the opportunity to get right with God, to come back to God, lest you face something even worse than being paralyzed. It's a little pointer to judgment day. More on that next week. Jesus does a sign in front of witnesses at the Pool of Bethesda to point to the fact that he is God who brings life and who judges the world. And I want to ask you whether you believe that. Are you convinced of that? Do you believe it enough to start to stake your life on it being true? To make costly decisions, gambled on the fact that Jesus really can deliver on his words. Well, the great thing is, it's not just a matter of having enough faith, you know, sort of persuading yourself to drum up enough religious enthusiasm. It's just a matter of history. Because this happened 2,000 years ago. And there's witnesses. And even Jesus' opponents grant that it happened, even though they're annoyed because he did it on a Saturday. And only the God who gives life could do this with a paralyzed man. Take up your bed and walk. Helpless, superstitions on which he pinned all of his help, or all of his hope. Nobody else able to do a thing for him. And just two sentences from Jesus. Do you want to be healed? Yes. Take up your bed and walk. Jesus isn't promising to heal everyone here who might have physical ailments or blindness or paralysis or cancer. He is promising on the last day to be the God who brings life. And this is the proof, the sign, the evidence to persuade us.